Welcome to UN Gender Focus. I'm Matthew Wells at UN headquarters in New York. Coming up in this week's programme, Australia is urged by a UN expert to stop locking up such a high proportion of Indigenous people, especially women and girls. And the male-dominated armies of the world make it hard for the UN to increase the proportion of women peacekeepers, says the former department chief. But first, access to services, removal of stigma and education are crucial aspects of promoting gender equality and empowering women to make decisions about their reproductive health. That's according to Dr. Babatunde Ositemhin, the Executive Director of the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA. He was at UN headquarters for a panel discussion on the sexual and reproductive health of young people. Following the discussion, Dr. Ositemhin spoke to Lucy Dean about the importance of sexual and reproductive education.
You must address poverty at the same time as you provide education. Because if you don't, then people are not empowered to be able to take advantage of the value of education, if you understand what I'm saying.
Rates of contraception in Africa remain, well, in West Africa, remain low. Why is that? What problems do they face?
Several factors. The first is access. Access is huge, because most of them don't have access. The second is the issue of demand creation. You need to create demand. People must know that it is there, and then they must be able to access it. The third, of course, is a lack of investment in this system to be able to do what they have to do. So when governments don't spend money on contraception, then people can't access it. And I think it's important.
So they're all connected, basically.
So it's about government leadership, understanding that this is an important human development intervention. It's about government putting budgets to it. It's about government and civil society creating demand. And it's about making sure that they can access services wherever they are. If you do those things, it will go up very, very clearly. Of course, there are other issues which surround it, like cultural, religious issues, but you know, you can take those also as you go along, because every country has culture, every country has religion, but we're able to overcome those things if you give power to the individual to take decisions about ourselves.
You mentioned culture and religion, and I assume stigma around sexual activity comes into that. How do we make it more comfortable for young people to discuss their sexuality and also be open
education,
about it?
Education. When we started talking about HIV, nobody wanted to accept that it existed. But after some time, today, it's even sexy to talk about HIV, because we've been able to message it, people now accept it, and it's part of society.
You said that it's also important for governments to invest in it. It seems like that's difficult to do without having young voices at the table.
I think young and old, everybody in society, it's a total society approach that we have to understand that the issue of gender equality and the issue of the dignity of women and girls must be central to development. And so, to that extent, you have to invest in it. Because if you don't invest in it, then they don't get it.
Australia must take action to reduce what one UN human rights expert sees as the country's astounding imprisonment rate for Indigenous people, particularly women and girls. Victoria Tauli-Corpuz said although Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders make up only 3% of the population, they constitute nearly 30% of those in jail. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous People has just concluded a 15-day official visit to the country. She reported that Indigenous women and girls make up more than 90% of prisoners at just one detention centre she visited. She spoke to Julia Dean.
It's really a very serious concern for me, you know, because young people, very young people, have been there, were arrested on very flimsy reasons, and they keep on going back. The recidivism is very high. So that one person said she has been back 17 times.
And what type of things have they been sent to these jails for?
Well, first, one person said that he just stole a fruit another person, another young person, said that he was sleeping in the trash bin, and then they found him. Even yelling at police officers. You know, those are the kinds of things that they are brought to jail for.
And why do you think they're doing this?
Racism, I think, you know. I mean, the police officers are trained to really think the worst of these people, and they think that punitive measures are the approaches that should be used against them. So I guess it's really an embedded kind of racism against in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
And when you talk about women and girls, did you see this with women and girls in the prisons as well?
I did see that as well. In fact, in that youth prison, I saw a young woman who is pregnant. And in the Bandiap women's prison, the prisoners told me that, first of all, they are so worried about health, because when they get sick, you know, they are not referred immediately to a specialist. So there was somebody who said that he had a stomach pains, and it up to now she has it, and she hasn't been referred to. So even the health services in those institutions are really quite, you know, very inadequate.
And were you surprised that in a country like Australia that this was happening?
I'm surprised, because a country like Australia, which is so rich, you know, cannot provide those kinds of services. I mean, it's like, for me, it's unthinkable. Of course, I saw the detention centers. They look very nice compared to what we have in the Philippines, for instance. But still, you know, the people are very, you know, the desperation, you can hear it in the voices. I ask them, what future do you see for yourself? And they look at you, said, what future? You know, and that's really, I think, the saddest thing that I've seen so far.
And the percentages of Indigenous peoples in these jails, when we're discussing these women and girls, is it a larger percentage of Indigenous women and girls that are going through these?
Yes,
conditions?
Definitely in the Bandiap prison, 95% of the detainees are Indigenous, are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. There are very few white women there. So there's really a very disproportionate representation of these people in the detention centres.
Victoria Tali Corpus talking to Julia Dean. Well, the fact that most of the world's armies are still male bastions has been a factor in limiting the number of women the UN can attract to peacekeeping operations. That's the view of Hervé Ladzous, who recently retired as head of UN peacekeeping, or DPKO. He said DPKO had become more efficient in recent years without lowering the quality of the often life-saving services it provides around the world. Around 126 countries contribute civilian, military and police personnel to DPKO, which is well over 100,000 people on active duty. Jocelyn Sambira asked Mr. Ladzous if he was satisfied with the progress DPKO had made recruiting more women.
We haven't made as much progress as I would have wished, but of course you have to be aware that the sociology of the armies of the main countries of the world is not a very feminine one, so we can hardly be expected to do much better than the member states who provide us the personnel. We are doing rather a little better for police. We stand, I think, right now at 12%, and the goal is that we may reach 20%, which I think we may be able to do. Also, I have set a goal for military officers, staff officers, military observers, you know, to get also 20% of female officers as soon as possible. But it requires a lot of work. And, of course, the active cooperation of those countries who contribute troops and police.
What about the countries where the peacekeepers are deployed? Has there been some resistance by some of these countries?
I think not. On the contrary, in several countries, we've tried to experiment, you know, with, for instance, all-female police units. And that has been very successful, for instance, in the DRC, in Liberia, in Haiti, because women suffer a great deal and probably more proportionately than men, you know, in those crises. And having an opportunity to interact with women police is, I think, a plus. Certainly the missions that have had this type of unit have been very positive in commenting and reporting upon them.
Jocelyn Sambira talking there to Hervé Ladzous. Well, you've been listening to UN Gender Focus from the United Nations in New York, and you can follow more of our programmes at radio.un.org. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Matthew Wells.